So I kind of come to a lot of these meetings, and I know we talk about community policing a lot, and a lot of times I feel like we're not all talking about the same thing. So will you tell me your or the police department's definition of community policing? Because oftentimes I really feel like the community organization, the police, we're not all talking about the same thing when we talk about community policing.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, because community policing is like, telling a police chief or any law enforcement executive to define community policing is like trying to tell somebody to define duty. I mean, you know, you're gonna ask 10 people, and you're gonna probably get 8 or 9 different answers to what it means. But I can tell you one, some consistent things though that you're gonna hear from most people on this topic, and that is that it's about working with the community to resolve issues, to resolve usually social issues before they become law enforcement incidents. We're trying to avoid having formal police action for issues that have a social basis. And a lot of the issues that we see in our communities across the country have this sort of social roots, you know, whether it's poverty or unemployment or mental health or substance abuse, lack of mentors in a person's life, economic opportunities. So if we can work as police officers and helping the community resolve those issues, then we can prevent crime from occurring, or if the police minimize the occurrences of crime. And so what you're going to see in many communities is you're going to see police officers that are embedded in, you know, a lot of different stakeholders in communities, like in the schools and nonprofits that deal with, you know, mental health and substance abuse and things like that. Again, with the goal of resolving issues.
All right.
Can I just ask you one question?
Yes.
You talked about coming up with different strategies for addressing violence. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. So the question is strategies for addressing violence in the community. And one of the most effective strategies that we've seen in Albany and we've seen across the country is this idea that we have to focus in a very precise way our efforts to address those who are committing violence in the community and those who are immediately associated with them. And this is why I say that. Because 25 or 30 years ago, what we saw in law enforcement in general across the country was this sort of shotgun approach to addressing issues that we're seeing. So we have crime, we know the crime is occurring, and we're going there, and we've saturated the area, we're making all kinds of stops, we're arresting as many people as we can. It was all about numbers, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily quality of arrests, but the numbers of arrests.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we found was that there was so much collateral damage. You know, we were arresting those who were committing some of the crimes, but in the meantime, you know, we were alienating communities because there was so much collateral damage, and so it started to shift. You know, somewhere around 10 or 15 years ago, to what, you know, whether you call it a focused deterrence approach, where now we're using intelligence, we're using technology, we're using collaborations and partnerships to specifically identify the individuals in our communities who are committing crimes. And then once we figure out who these individuals are, then we devote our resources in a very precise way in terms of taking those individuals out of our community. Second part of that is helping those who may be susceptible to violence. They haven't yet committed crimes, or they've committed crimes and they're not currently offenders. But while we're taking away, in a precise way, the most violent of the individuals in our community, what are we doing with those who are susceptible to violence? Are we helping those to find a way to get out of this cycle so that we don't continuously just arresting the same people over and over and over again and starting keeping the cycle going? So it's really a two-pronged approach.
And she put it on her
camera. How do you do that without violating due process rights? How does that work? I don't understand how it works. So you think somebody's prone to doing, engaging in violent crime. How do you identify that person, and how do you take that person out? I don't understand that.
And so when we say prone to violence, that's not necessarily what I'm talking about. What I'm saying is, there are a number of individuals in any community. There's a small group of individuals that are responsible for a large amount of the crime in any, especially urban cities that you have.
Right. But they're the ones that would be prosecuted if they committed crime.
But they'd be caught. They have to be apprehended. They have to be identified. Because what we're saying in a lot of communities is that small group of individuals almost hide in the shadows. And so they're permitted to continue with some of the mayhem that's going on in these communities, because the intelligence and the partnerships and the technology is not being used appropriately to identify those individuals. What I'm saying is that this small group of individuals who are committing crimes in the city of Albany, we're identifying them when they're committing these crimes.
And we are arresting them
and we're prosecuting
them. If they commit a crime. Then how do you deal with, you mentioned something about people around them?
And the ones who are around them, and then so we identify associates.
Yeah.
And their associates, we help them to avoid this cycle. And that's what I mean by this other piece of it. How are we keeping those who may be susceptible? Because what we're finding is that people who are closely associated with individuals who are committing violence in the community are highly susceptible and at high risk of committing crimes themselves or becoming victims of crimes. And so when we're identifying those individuals, it's not in an enforcement capacity. It's in a way of offering some resources and offering some ideas on how they themselves can escape becoming a perpetrator or a victim of crime. And so it widens the net now. Now there's more of a preventative aspect to the crime. So because if we just identify and focus on those who are committing crimes, there's always those who are influenced by those individuals in the community. And so those individuals who are influenced will, some point in the future, there's a high chance that they may become perpetrators or victims of violence, and that's what we want to prevent. So we've got that two-pronged approach.
So you have a group of people that are in the category you just described. What do you do with them?
We have an anti-violence coordinator that works within the police department. It's a civilian person who, once we identify an individual who has committed violence in this community, and this person has committed a crime,
right,
and we have taken some action against that person, whether it be an arrest or, in most cases, arrest and prosecution, then we're looking at the circle around this person.
Yeah.
And once we identify who that circle is, then we offer voluntary services. We find out are they unemployed? Do they have issues with finding suitable educational opportunities? Are they dealing with extreme poverty where they may need some other form of assistance? Do they have mental health issues that we can kind of give them some ideas on where they can go to address some of those issues? So it's more in a capacity of helping those people.
Well, I mean, that's great if we could do that. I'm just saying, so you identify this person. What gives you the authority to go after that person and do whatever you want to do on them?
I'm sorry, which person are you talking about?
The person who has not committed a crime, but you think that they...
We have no authority. This is totally voluntary. We go in this anti-violence coordinator and the team that this person has, they go and offer services. Simply offer.
He's a police officer.
These are civilians. These are civilians. They may be assisted by police officers, but the group is run by civilians. And they're simply offering services to people in that circle because, like I said, we're saying that those in that circle, those who are associated, have a high risk of becoming victims or perpetrators of crime. And we're trying to prevent both.
Is there, as of about 15 years ago, I know that The Los Angeles Police Department was pioneering a concept that they called predictive policing.
Yes.
It was a Bill Bratton thing. He's famous for data-driven models, and the idea was to collect as much information as possible. People had contact with the police and other government agencies, and collect it and analyze it, and you would identify the people. I don't know how far along that has gotten.
But I think it's important that I make sure that I'm very clear on this point. As it pertains to those who have not committed crimes.
Right.
I just want to be very clear on this. We are targeting in a very, very precise way those who have committed violent crimes in this community. And once we identify those individuals, then they are arrested and prosecuted. At that time, we're identifying individuals who may be associated with them with the intent of helping those individuals to not become victims or perpetrators of violence. And we offer services that are totally voluntary for them to engage in. So they have an absolute right to refuse any offers of services that we have. And we're connected with the number of social agencies in the community and other sort of resources. And we simply offer those resources, and that's it.
Excuse me, Chief.
Yes, sir.
In that capacity, I do believe that, first of all, I do believe that introducing more trauma, potential of introducing more trauma. If there's 1% chance of introducing more trauma, that's 1% too much. And that's coming from experience. Where's the community, grassroots community approach in this? Where's the grassroots community connection in this? Because I think what the two-prong approach, I think what you were just describing should be better suited coming out of a community. And then getting what BPD's role in that can be helping identify the resources to have that sustained and making sure that we can get the proper resources. We have experts in these communities. All we got to do is call upon those experts in this. I see some experts in this room. We have experts in these communities that survive in these communities. Some of them survive some of the same things that you're speaking about. How can we go and tap into that? You know, and make sure that we provide that table, you know, and it's not the boogeyman approach. I remember, you know, I don't care if this is a villain or not, you knock on my door and it's that look, it's still a boogeyman to me. Mm-hmm. It's still somebody coming to tell me what I need and what my family mm-hmm. need. You know, it's going to be the door shut in the face. And if it's, you know, so just looking at maximizing that potential. How can the collaboration be there? Really putting the onus, like not the onus, but really putting a focus on the community and then saying, how can I give them resources to make sure that it's successful in those communities? That's my soapbox.
I think she's trying to be very clear that we're not pushing anybody towards any type of service. We're offering. They have a full right to say no.
You're using this type of prediction, right? That because of course, if somebody commits a crime, chances are they've probably been influenced by something criminal in their life that helped lead them to that. Yeah, sure, we can follow that logic. But by criminal, lots of reasons, whatever the reason is, but by kind of assuming that if you're around that, like, you're more likely to become a criminal, doesn't that inevitably criminalize entire communities and stereotypes in a way that is more harmful?
I think it's important to emphasize that other part, too. We're trying to prevent people from becoming victims also.
Right. But let's develop better, you know, more holistic solutions for this that isn't necessarily, that shouldn't be policing, you know, that's more restorative, that's more resource-based, and I recognize there's constraints when it comes to different programs, you know, and I recognize that a lot of state agencies are strained right now, but if we don't prioritize this, all the other problems that are screening us are just going
to
get worse.
Yeah, and just to follow up on this here, I see where you're coming from, and I see with some of the reservations that are on something like this. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to understand that this is part of a comprehensive approach to addressing some of these things. Now, you can take a police department and tell the police department all you're going to do is just go arrest violent criminals. And that's fine. We can do that. I think it was very, very progressive for this department to take an approach to say, not only are we going to address violent criminals in this community, but we also understand that it's a humane way for us to address things by also looking at those who may be impacted.
I agree. And this will be my last thing.
But you can't predict. No one can predict criminality.
I'm saying maybe you could predict this. Maybe they'll be at high risk for poverty and needing assistance. Maybe they're at high risk of needing housing assistance or certain other resources. But I don't think it translates into them more likely to be a criminal.
I'm going to come right to you. And I understand going into here, and I'll come right back to you. But the key thing we can't forget about this is that these are totally voluntary services. These are not police officers coming knocking on the door saying you're going to be a criminal and if you don't do this, you're going to do this. This is, I think, a police department acting in a very humane way and saying that there are other people in this community besides violent criminals that we can help.
I said minimize
the chances of those individuals becoming either a perpetrator or a victim of crime. We don't want to have to come back and arrest some guy's best friend because this guy is upset because his best friend was killed or because his best friend was assaulted. We don't want to have this cycle. So what we want to do is offer them some services and some ideas to do that. So the intent is solely to offer voluntary services to individuals that they can freely decline so that maybe it can help them navigate a very, very traumatic incident.
I think the resources that you're offering is not the source of contention. The source of contention is how you identify those folks in the first place. So in the black community, because we are over-policed, we are arrested more
easily,
and all of us probably know somebody who is a criminal. So by your definition, because we associate with criminals, then everybody in the whole community is at high risk of either being harmed or being a criminal, and that's where it's infuriating.
And I'll come to you, you're next. And also understand that this philosophy transcends race. It doesn't matter who the person is, it transcends everybody.
And that's a tone deaf comment. Ask any black person in here if they agree with you. They will tell you no. It does not transcend race. We are police. I have lived in Albany 43 years. I have lived in almost every ward, South End, Arbor Hill. White people live.
You missed what I said.
We are police different.
You missed what I said. I didn't see that nobody.
You said it transcends race.
I said the philosophy in terms of us going and helping people who are maybe impacted by either crime as a victim or as a suspect. I said that is something that transcends. We do that with everybody. I'm not arguing, and I would never say that communities across the country are police the same. I mean, that would be ridiculous for me as an African-American to say something like that. I would never say that. What I'm saying is we have a policy that whether it happens in Pine Hills or South End, if somebody knows somebody who was involved in violent crime, then we want to try to offer those folks some services so that they can avoid becoming a victim or avoid becoming a suspect. So we don't have to over-police. So we don't have to go back and say and help this person who may.
She probably didn't disagree with you. The reason I say that is that what you just said, if she and I actually, please share this briefly, an incident that happened, right? And it's not policed the same, and it was not policed the same, and we tried to do it, but we intervened because...
Before you go, let me preface this by saying, did I just say to the young lady over here, that I understand that there are some disparities between how communities are policed. Okay? And that's across the country, we understand that. So I'm not saying that, and that's not what I said to her. Okay?
Then I have a question with that. What he is talking about is, I'm a felon, I'm considered a violent felon. Over a month and a half ago, young ladies came to my house with butcher knives. I 911 four times. Mm-hmm. That's what happened because I had an ankle monitor on. It's off now. When the police came, they went from me to them. I'm the victim. Mine, I have a 12-year-old son. My daughter's 18 and a grandbaby that's 7 months old. So it went from me. Remind you, I called 911 four times. It went from a look down to across the street where they had the butcher knives at. No arrest still. That night, my daughter was tasered, maced, hit in the head with two cans in the stop, and still nothing has been done. Yeah, I'm on parole. That doesn't mean because I was a violent felon, that doesn't mean I haven't changed. So I got to disagree with you because currently the case is still open. The detective is Romero or whatever his name is. I'm not getting any help whatsoever, but you let somebody call on me and say, well, she just hit me. I'm going for parole violation, parole hold, no bail, but it's all right for me and my family to be victimized because I made a mistake in the past.
And you live on Clinton Avenue.
I live on Clinton Avenue. I've evolved since then. My mistakes have made me a better woman, a better mother, a better grandmother, but yet I'm still paying for my mistakes. So tell me where we're going to go. And what about the evidence generated versus evidence based in approaches? Can we talk about all this too?
Certainly. I'm willing to. So let me take your first part. So you have a problem with how police handle your incident.
All right, and just so you know, last year the same family cut me, assaulted me and my, it was just me and my own children, assaulted me and my family, my grandchildren were on the porch. There was a video, parole pressed me, they said file the charges. I filed the charges and they walked away. Mm-hmm. But it's still the same family that I'm not gonna show, I'm a totally different person, so what am I supposed to do? Are they gonna almost kill my daughter right here on South Pearl Street?
So there's a couple of different ways that you can handle it, okay? Because it sounds like you're dissatisfied with how the police handle your incident. And so you can, I mean, we have CPRB, Community Police Review Board members who are here who can take complaints about an incident. So you can look into this, because this is the first I'm hearing about it, and I need to know more.
I've also talked with Christian, and my favorite is like the investigator. Christian Dean or something like that.
So we can connect you with somebody. If you have a complaint about the way that the police behave or handle your incident, then we can certainly
do
that.
Also, I called 911. I wasn't even listed in the report. My daughter was being as a victim. Well, later on, and they said where they went to my daughter-in-law's house and beat my daughter, but I couldn't file charges because I wasn't listed on a report. So yeah, I definitely have a problem with that, and I definitely have, you know, people, like I said, I have a past, but that doesn't say I'm the same person, and I feel like, and I'm like, wrong, once a violent felon doesn't make you a violent felon forever. It just doesn't.
I agree.
Have a mom and a grandmother now.
I agree, and if they didn't behave in the appropriate way, then I need to look into that, and I need to know it.
Yeah, I'm ready.
So we need to connect you with the folks so you can make a complaint so we can take a look at that, okay?
All right,
you're welcome. Yes, ma'am.
So I have a question. So we're, like you said, our communities are over-policed. We have all the media story where you support. Our people are not comfortable even at a taxi stop. How do you feel that you can handle a situation to make us feel more comfortable? What is your, you keep talking about in-house stuff. Your offices are in-house, but stay in-house. So how are the community supposed to
because I have a duty, this city has a duty to produce officers that treat people with dignity and respect.
That's not
you know, if it's not happening, then that's something that we need to address. And this, here's how we address it. If somebody is mistreated, then I need to know that you were mistreated. I need to know when it was, get the information, so we can look into it, and so we can take the appropriate corrective action. I think I've demonstrated in my little bit over a year here as chief that when things happen, and if there's some improprieties that happen within the police department, that the appropriate action gets taken. So what I need to do is to hear that. But it goes even further than that, because you're telling me that people fear the police, they don't feel comfortable with traffic stops and things like that. And so that goes to a number of different things. What type of people are we recruiting to this department? What type of people are we retaining? What type of training are they getting? And then what type of oversight on top of all of that is happening in terms of making sure that there are consequences for inappropriate behaviors. So it's a multi-tiered thing. It's not real complex, because it's just a matter of making sure that people treat people with dignity and respect. Her question is,
how does he propose with his officers to get the rate, how many use of force actions they have against them to get them down where our black, where the officers and our young men is not being hurt and the use of force is not being used against them?
And so a lot of that comes to, one of the things that we're doing here and that we're starting to see this becoming a trend across the country is helping officers to de-escalate. Because it used to be a time when something would happen and it would justify a use of force at this level. And then circumstances changed. And now the use of force that's justified changes. And were we having officers that were making those appropriate adjustments? As part of the training that we get right now in our defensive tactics and all the physical training we're getting right now, de-escalation is a huge piece of it. And if you would ask the police department, you would ask any chief 5 years ago that, what's de-escalation? How does that fit into all this? They were here, they committed a crime and we had to take them in and they should have complied and all this other stuff. But no, we're teaching our officers that when circumstances change, then they have to change their level of force with that. Sometimes force is necessary, but the appropriate force to be administered is what's important. That's one of the things we're just training our officers, giving them a lot of training there right now.
Excuse me, across the street name.
I want to go back to that picture we talked about after the movie. I feel like we get the incentive and the intention behind it, but the problem is that it assumes a positive relationship between the community and the police, like the police. Even if it's a service, there isn't that kind of platform in the okay, so I feel that you go and mind people's business, but you should build a relationship between the two. So that they feel that you are someone that they can come to be protected by. Yeah. So I feel like that will only work by people who they trust more. So you have to build that trust. Right now,
the
state of America,
they
just don't deserve
to help them. So her comment was that in order for the strategies that I talked about to work, and there needs to be trust between the police department and the community that it's serving. And I know, Ray, you guys should move on. But let me just, this is a critical point. And I'm glad you brought this up. Because you're absolutely right. There is an issue in this country with trust of the police, particularly from the minority community, particularly from African Americans. And in 2014, President Obama commissioned a task force on 21st century policing to look at this issue. And it was one of the more profound and impactful studies that I've seen in my almost 30 years of experience.
how they analyzed what this issue was, they recognized it, and came up with some solutions for law enforcement agencies across the country. And here's what was so surprising, not surprising, but really jumped out at me when I read that report. Because I knew it anecdotally about how minorities felt about policing. But there was a study that was within that study that showed that going back almost 35 years, they measured the satisfaction of policing among races. And it's consistent for almost 35 years that African Americans, minorities, have more distrust of the police than whites. And that was consistent for all of these years. And so President Obama understood that, and he knows that this is some deep-rooted issues that were involved in this, some generational issues that was involved in it, knew that trust had to be built, and knew that it took generations for it to get to where it was, and it was going to probably take some years to kind of get our way out of it. And so offer some strategies. Offer strategies for law enforcement agencies to deal with this. And this department was recognized by the president as being one of the, was it 15? 15 men? One of the 15 agencies across the country who had accepted, embraced, and started to implement these solutions that were in this study. This study was done by some of the brightest minds in this country. In law enforcement, in education, and in other fields, and he came up with these strategies, and a lot of the strategies are some of the things you talk about, dealing with implicit bias, making sure that we have procedural justice both internally and externally, because if you treat your staff members in a procedurally just way, they're more likely to come back to what you're saying, ma'am. We're talking about how they treat people. Studies have shown that if we treat our officers in a procedurally just way, they tend to treat others in a procedurally just way, those that they're serving. So a lot of our strategies are internal strategies in terms of building our officers that way. But it's a very, very impactful study that showed and it exemplified the commitment that this department has to all of the community policing principles that the members of this study had recommended.
I have to call time.
Okay.
All right. I think you can hang around.
Yes, sir. Sorry,
I'll sit.
Thank you all.
I'd like to recognize we have a couple of county council members here, Kevin Hugo and Judy Duchesne, and we also have the chair of the Civilian Police Review Board, Abby Miller.
All right, and now I think Dr. Griffiths and Jason Wheeler. Okay, you might get some ideas. Yeah, I'm sure.
There's a microphone that has to call loud.
So we're going back.
Okay. First of all, I want to thank Ray Moran for inviting us to talk about the report that we've done, the public safety report, pathway to reform and change, public safety, law enforcement, and the Albany community. And I know this is Ray's last night as the chair of ACTAC. So I want to congratulate him on the work that he's done with that group. We also have some of our center staff who connected with that report. Judy Chen right here. and of course, Lauren. And do we have other people here?
Oh, our intern.
Oh, well, new intern, right?
Okay.
Laura. Oh, Laura. Yeah. She came to the report. We're going to discuss this by showing some of the highlights of the report and hopefully get your questions that you might have about that particular report. I was happy to hear somebody finally bring up the issue regarding distrust. This is one of the main reasons why we did the report. And so we're going to be talking a lot about that. And also, we wanted to do this report to give sort of a snapshot of people in the community who were concerned about this issue of distrust. Okay? And we also hope to create some dialogue and discussion about trust and law enforcement and public safety. So, but the ultimate thing was to talk about transformative change rather than talking about, you know, bits and pieces of moving things around and doing some of the same things that we've been doing for years. So that was the basis for this. One of the things I think we miss very often is the history behind all of this. Just want to tell you one thing, and then you'll ask me why I'm talking about this, but I'll explain it. My great-grandmother was born in 1859, which means that she was born enslaved. And I had the great fortune of being around before she died, and as a very young child. And she talked a lot about her experiences to other people about having that enslavement experience. She raised my mother, the grandmother, raised my mother. So she taught her everything that she knew about living under enslavement. And one of the things she taught her was about cooking. Cooking was an important piece of what her and her family did. And so my mother then taught me things that she had learned from her grandmother. So I, today, cook like my mother and hence my great-grandmother. And I tell that because too often we think that enslavement was so long ago that it's immaterial. And we also have this notion that everything disappeared once enslavement ended. But things are handed down.
That's right.
And this is really important when we talk about policing. Okay? And it's something that we ignore when we have these kinds of discussions and talk about this issue. Because what had happened during her period was that policing was born. And it was born in such a way that it was totally devoted to controlling,
right,
punishing,
yes,
and harming black people.
Mm-hmm.
And these stories that happened, the stories about what happened that period, got handed down. So African Americans have this collective memory that we operate from. But we never talk about it when we talk about policing. Distrust is based in that period. Okay? And we still recognize it. I just wanted, there's a black police officer who, David Thomas, who is head of the Police Foundation senior research fellow. And here's what he says. I can find it. Americans have short memories when it comes to uncomfortable reality of truth that interferes with our way of life. When slavery is brought up, police and others often argue slavery has nothing to do with where we are today. I am not responsible for what happened 300 years ago. You probably heard that yourself. What is lost in this argument and what the law enforcement community fails to recognize is that our past is the root of problems today.
That's right. Thank you.
The stories have been handed down about law enforcement involvement in oppressing black people. They played a significant role in returning runaways, physical assault, rape, whipping, pain. All those things are still with us. So when we talk about what are we going to do about dealing with issues around distrust and policing, we exclude that. We also exclude the issue of racism.
Yes.
You know, we did not talk about that tonight when we were talking about what we're going to do. Racism, structural racism, is the issue.
Mm.
You can teach implicit bias all you want.
Thank you.
It only refers to the individual. The individual can say, yeah, I'm biased. You know, like, please excuse me for what I do because I'm biased.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't get us anywhere. We have to be talking about systemic.
Thank you.
Systemic issues. Systemic implicit bias is no longer fashionable and useful to talk about implicit bias. It doesn't get you anywhere. Okay? It gives you an excuse for what you do in terms of harming people.
Sure.
This morning there was also this black journalist, Cynthia Tucker. She said, the culture of policing is infused with racism, weighed down by stereotypes and infested with officers with a victim mentality. This nation has spent centuries demonizing black and brown people as lawless, and police departments reek of that conditioning. Those are very important issues, and we can't ignore them. Why did we do this report? People contact our office at the Center for Law and Justice. They tell us what's going on with them on the street. We can't ignore that. They talk about issues around distrust. We can't ignore that. And the other thing is that they did not have a voice that people were listening to regarding this issue of distrust. So one of the things we want to do, and this is not an attack on the police department, because I'm talking about systemic things, okay? So if a police officer abuses you, that is an individual. But that individual might act in such a way because of the culture within the police department, which says that black people need to be stereotyped. They're criminals. Mm-hmm. And so you respond, you react to that community based on those stereotypes. But that's part of the system. And getting rid of that one police officer isn't going to do you a whole lot of good. Okay? They must be held accountable. I understand that. But it doesn't deal with the real problem that we have in policing today. So we wanted to make sure that people who come to us talking about these issues, they blame racism oftentimes. We wanted them to have a voice. We wanted to know more about what they were thinking and what they see as the problem in terms of public safety, how they look at our law enforcement, not just police, but the district attorney's office. So our questionnaire was developed to get at those responses. And so what I'm going to do is sort of go through, I don't know, how many of you read the report? Okay, so you probably will know what I'm talking about. First, I have to look around and not see what's on the screen. Okay, you gave it to me.
And I can move to where you are.
Okay.
Look around.
Okay. First of all, this report is not the first thing that we've done on this issue of policing. We have done 5 or 6 reports, and it's listed up there, the ones that we've done. And this is, you know, the latest one. We decided that we would do a questionnaire so people could respond to concerns that they might have. This is the questionnaire that we use, and everybody should have a copy of it so you can see the kind of questions that we ask. And then there's a second part of it where we ask people to give us some idea of whether there was a particular event that happened in the community that allowed them to come to their particular perspective on what was going on. Okay, the next thing you see is the city of Albany arrests and demographics. We thought that was important for you to know, to see who's in our community and what the arrest rate for all those people are. And that needs to be explained at some point. As you can see, blacks are often arrested. And that perpetuates the stereotype. People involved in criminal behavior are not because of their race. You know, there's nothing that connects race with crime. There is more of a relationship between poverty and crime, but not race. But we're continually saying that black people are prone to crime. And that's why I was questioning about that issue when we were talking about predictive policing. Okay? So that becomes a problem. Now, in terms of who responded, this tells you who responded to the survey. What we did was we had individuals who were trained to go out and conduct the survey, and we also had it on website so that people could respond as well. And this also shows you the age range and all of those demographics that of people who are involved in this particular survey. Now, I want to make sure you understand that this is not a scientific survey, which would take a lot more time and resources to do. We simply wanted to, as I said, have a snapshot to get those comments from people about how they see public safety in this particular community and also the way they relate to law enforcement.
And I'd like to point out every zip code didn't respond. These are just the top five zip codes from the city of Albany.
Right. The other thing is that there were some people who did, more people responded. We ended up with 256 that we used. But there are other people who respond. Some of them indicated, again, this gets back to the issue of trust. Some of them were afraid that they could be identified from their zip code. That just shows you the level of distrust that there is in the community. And so we did not use them. And there's nothing wrong with the number of people who responded to the survey. Other surveys have fewer numbers than we did. But anyway, that was and after doing an analysis, I mean, Judy did worked on this and did a really good job. It's hard for me to see what's on their screen. We ended up with, the four major findings. That's on there. Okay. The four major findings, first of all, was that blacks and brown people report very strong feelings of mistrust of the Albany Police Department. The other thing, they also express great mistrust of the district attorney's office as well. And most participants strongly disagreed that the district attorney's office handles cases in a fair manner. The other thing, and this is where the center is involved, is that LEAD, which is Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, which we've been working on trying to educate people about the program and to work with the police department and others in dealing with people who have certain types of issues and problems that are diverted from the system. We found that not as many people as we'd hope know about LEAD, because there's very little discussion about it in the community, and there are no resources attached to LEAD for a director or a community organizer at this particular point anyway. But there are also the open-ended question. There were several themes that were reported on the qualitative part of this report. And I think they're listed there. Police misconduct was the top one. People still report police misconduct as being a problem. Racism, people saw racism as an issue in terms of how the police operate and law enforcement in general. And people were very concerned about the incident that happened on First Street. As you probably know, when the police went in and took someone out of their apartment, and also the Elazar Williams case was another one that people are really disturbed about and had an impact on the issue of trust. So those are things that, you know, we have to be real about, we have to be honest about, that those are problems and our community sees them as problems and they're looking for us to figure out how we can deal with it. So one of the things that we did, the most important thing I think we did with this report, is to come up with recommendations based on our long experience. The Center for Law and Justice has been doing this work for 35 years. Next year is our 35th year. So we've experienced a lot of stuff with policing. And we work very closely with the police department, and we want to continue that work because I think it's really important. So I'll just mention a couple of these recommendations, and then I'm going to tell you what we're going to do in terms of trying to bring about change, and then I'll let you ask questions. First of all, we felt that the leaders should embrace the report findings. It's not a scientific survey, but I think it speaks to what people are feeling and how they perceive what's going on in the community. So don't tell me that because it's an unscientific study that you can just ignore it, because I think that would be a real problem, because people are saying these things, they're thinking them, and to ignore that would be a problem. We also have to acknowledge what I just mentioned about structural racism. And there's been a lot of great books out recently about this issue, and we have to understand what structural racism is. And I think it's important for the police department, especially, to understand what structural racism is. You know, that culture, the history, and how people relate to the community, the stereotypes, again, of certain people in our community, and what they do. And let's see, I'll skip down to a couple of these. Someone raised a question about, have the police officers get any lessons on civil rights history and on the historical relationship between the police and the community. Mm-hmm. We are recommending that law enforcement officers must be taught civil rights history.
Yes.
And that is really key, because you can't understand the anger and the distrust for the people that you're policing if you don't know where it comes from. Okay, so we have to do that. We're already starting now to talk to colleges, especially SUNY, about helping with that particular, developing a curriculum on that. So we would like to draw the college and the university in. Mm-hmm. Talk about this. Mm-hmm. Oh, the other thing is, and this should be easy to do, about 2010 or 11, the Albany Police Department invited a number of community residents in to develop a policy on racial profiling. We did that, and then 2011 happened, and the police department did not want to release it, because they felt that they had to do some racial profiling because we're now looking at immigrants. So we have never done that, and I don't know why. So I think that's a recommendation that could be taken and worked on very quickly. We believe that racial impact statements must be in the department when they come up with new policies and new programs. We need to know how they think that these policies are going to actually impact particular groups, particularly African Americans. Mm-hmm. ACPAC, we're at a meeting with ACPAC now. We're disappointed that it has not been reorganized, and there are many empty seats, my understanding, that have not been filled. And that's the organization that's been working very closely with the police department. And we don't see any reason why we need to develop other organizations or groups, because ACPAC can do that. But they need, you know, they need support, and they need for those positions to be filled.
What support are you looking for?
Excuse me?
What support are you saying that ACPAC?
Well, let me finish, okay, because that's something I want to get from you. We also recommend that all police shootings be investigated. That is key. We don't have to talk about whether it should or shouldn't, but they should. That should be done.
Excuse me, Dr. Green. Did you skip over section 50?
Yes, I want to know what.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, because that one's really
important. We're asking the repeal of 58, which is the civil service law that doesn't allow the public to have information about individual police officers and their, particularly their use of force.
Yes.
And so, and there's a real effort across the state to get rid of 58. That there's a duty that we should know if a police officer is assigned to our community, that we should know if they've been abusing people over the last, you know, 14 number of years.
You get to look up reviews for your
California district number 12, which is a new, your state should pass stricter police use of force legislation. Because what happens now is we said, no one quite understands what the policy is and how it's carried out. And we find that when police officers are, in some instances, found guilty of something or accused of something, they will strictly say, well, I thought I was in danger, my life was in danger, kind of thing. So we're looking for a stricter one. And California just did it. Okay. The Albany County District Attorney's Office should be more transparent to the public. We found that people that had no idea how the District Attorney's Office operates, what their policies are, what their staffing is like, you know, including the District Attorney not clearly defining special prosecutor policy. We went through that with the LSR case, and people were very upset about that and still are. We also recommend that there be annual reports done by the District Attorney's Office and the Police Department that's made public. And I looked at one at SUNY, which is very complete, and we've actually asked for this for a long time, but it has never happened. That there's no reason why the Police Department should not do an annual report that tells the community what it's been doing, what some of the issues are, and, you know, how other things are going in terms of training, whatever it happens to be. So
just at that point there, we have an annual report that we publish every year, and it's, you know, it's our perspectives that we do with it, and heads up, because I saw the one that you sent from you all, and it's one that it mirrors what they do there, and it's something that we've been doing for years here. So it's publicly available.
Yeah. What we were recommending is not only to do that report, but that it gets it could be discussed in common council. It gets distributed to the community. I've never seen one. I don't know. See, if people don't know it's there, it's not worth a whole lot.
We distribute it every year to the common council.
Yeah, but we've never seen it.
And it's publicly available to the...
Yeah. Okay, I'm glad you told me that, because nobody's ever seen it.
Is that the city website? I was looking for it.
It's publicly available, very comprehensive report that talks about all of it.
Yeah, can that be put on the website, like,
is there one for this
tomorrow?
Yes.
It's on the police website.
Do you know about it? You're on the Common Council.
Well, we have been getting it.
Okay. How come there's been no discussion about it?
And we have asked for anything tomorrow, the Finance Committee is meeting with the APD. We have asked for materials that are going to be provided at least 24 hours in advance so that we can review it.
and asking Ellen questions about it. Ideally, we would get it before that. So we haven't received that.
Is there usually a review of it at the Common Council meeting with the public?
There is. Well, it is a public meeting. All the Finance Committee meetings are public, and there is some review of it, but it's a rather lengthy document, and usually we're more focused on the budget. The prospectus does impact the budget to some extent because it will have the five-year capital plan usually is part of that, but there's a lot of other materials in it before that. Is it available online?
And I'm not sure if it's online or not. And if you haven't gotten it, then I've got to check because it's complete. It's complete for this year. And I was under the assumption that it had already been forwarded to council, but it is complete for this year.
ACPAC did not get it.
Excuse me?
We'll get it to our legislative aid and have her put it on.
Okay, that'd be great.
Yes, I'll read it.
Are we talking about a different annual report than like the prospectus or like the strategic plan? That's the same document we're talking about.
It's prospectus. Yeah.
Okay, because I have taken a look at that. I didn't realize that was the same thing as what you were talking about with the annual report.
Not get it.
Okay, well, I'm glad you told me that because we were under the impression that it didn't exist because nobody's ever said anything about it.
ideally, it would be reviewed in the Common Council's Public Safety Committee meeting as well because they're supposed to do the oversight of the police department, the fire department, so the Finance Committee can do a certain amount of review, but we're reviewing all the department's budgets at this particular time, so it's really not conducive to a real in-depth discussion and really should be that other committee.
Well, I'm just asking you to know
that. For us residents, how do we read it? How do we get our hands on it?
So I don't know if it's on the city website or not.
I said no.
Usually do it by the police department. That's where it used to go. Your daily annual report.
And in any case, going forward, we'll make sure that.
Okay, we can cross that off our list. I don't have to do that. And cross one thing off. But
why don't we change that list then?
Yeah.
I've seen it for years. I mean, I went back and they go back to Crowfoot days and.
The Crowfoot did it on his part, at least. Yeah, portion of the city website.
Okay, but generally in the community, I don't think anybody knew it was there.
No.
And like the SUNY one, they sent it to me, so I knew it was there.
but the thing is, I would caution, it's a lot of budgetary stuff.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that it would exactly have what information you're looking for.
It's a little bit more of an emotional piece.
Right.
There's a lot in there about, commitments to ethical policing and different training programs and stuff you're planning on doing. I'd be, maybe not now's not the right time, but I'd be curious to hear about how it's developed, who's developing it, types of, community input opportunities for your plans and how that works.
Yeah. Well, definitely the community needs to know that it exists.
Right.
Because we didn't. So I apologize for that. I don't know what it is. I've been asking people for it. Nobody ever told me that they had it.
What about the district attorney's office? Do they do one?
No. And the district attorney, we're talking about both the police department and the district attorney's office. And I don't know. We have seen nothing from the district attorney's office.
If the document is, if we're hearing that it's fairly terse with a lot of budgetary stuff,
it's really not.
There must be.
Oh, it's not?
Maybe some parts of it.
I mean, nonetheless, could it become a new tradition that maybe the Center for Law and Justice, makes that you get it every year and kind of parse it down into a digestible form.
You want to help us do that.
Well, a report usually has an executive summary, too.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear you.
I said a report usually has an executive summary that, isn't all that detailed, but at least is an overview.
That would be a beginning.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
And I also believe on the recommendation, there should be annual mandatory meetings with the chief, the mayor, and the district attorney as a community meeting for the community to come and we can talk, they can ask them questions and they can ask those questions. Because the meetings get put together, the chief sometimes shows, sometimes he doesn't, sometimes the mayor shows, sometimes he doesn't. The district attorney soars, there's always MIA. These should be mandatory meetings, especially when we have when we're trying to form a relationship between the community and the police and the trust. These should be mandatory meetings, I
believe. Yeah. Let me just touch on that because you're right, I think that's a great thing. And just to clear up, I've participated in probably a dozen of these over the last 6 months or so. Just open forum community meetings where anything could be asked. I haven't missed one. Haven't turned out any invitations from the public for these. So I agree. And
I apologize because I can see you, so I can't make everyone.
It's on the website.
It's on the website. So you go to albanyny.gov, and then you can see a listing of, it'll say departments, and then if you look on the police department, it'll give you a menu.
Yeah. Okay. What I'm going to ask you about that.
It has the 2019 perspective. I don't know if
you have it. 2020 is done. And that's the one that you have received. And that one will be some of the sources.
Okay, moving on. I know we're running out of time. What we did with this report? This report we see becoming a living document. We're not just going to take it and put it on our, in our files, but we want to use it to monitor and track any changes that take place related to those recommendations. And the first one we got is the report, the annual report, so we can sort of cross that one off, which is good. So what we did was when we did the report, we asked certain officials to read it and respond to it. We sent it to the mayor's office, the president of the Common Council, the Public Safety Committee, the Common Council members, and the Albany Police Department. Albany County District Attorney's Office. Hard copies were distributed. Those who wanted them. Digital copies are available online, so you can go and do that. The living document also caused us to request comments and feedback from some of the key officials in the city, like the mayor's office, the Albany Police Department, and the Albany County Attorney's Office. Other requested comments and feedback were, we asked Lee to do the same thing, the Albany Common Council President, the Public Safety Chair, the Albany Common Council, and we distributed information at Mississippi Day event. In terms of responses, Chief Eric Hawkins did respond, and we got responses from Corey Ellis and Dorsey Clears from the Common Council. We got a lot of media responses as well. So what we're doing now is trying to come up with a system to, as I said, monitor, to track and evaluate what has been done, what's left to be done, and then to sort of issue a report at the end of the year about what we've actually done. So that includes tracking, long-term kind of investment stuff, monitoring all the responses, so we will be able to check off when something is done. And at the end, when we look at it, we'll at least be able to hold some of these officials accountable for not doing some of the things that they had maybe said they were going to do or we expect them to do. And then we sort of go from there. So it's going to be around for the whole year, and we're going to very closely monitor what's going on in the departments that we mentioned. Okay? So that's basically what the report is. If you have any questions, I don't know if they're
coming. Are you going to publish any of the responses you get from our leadership? Because I would like to know what some of them say, some of the county council people.
That will be part of our report. We, as I said, we haven't gotten that many. The ones I just mentioned, we didn't get either verbal or some written comments and responses.
Okay. And so far, what we've been able to collect is up on the web, right under the tab of the survey. It says what's being said.
So it'll be something like
that. I want to know my beginning question. What support are you talking about for ACPAC?
Well, that's what, you know, we're saying that ACPAC needs some help somewhere. You are probably in a good position to...
I'm not on ACPAC anymore.
Okay. The first thing would help is to have a full...
committee?
So I don't know what that's going to take. You know, I don't know if they need resources. I don't know. And support from the police department, I would think. But you can
come. There's a membership. I'm going to the common council tomorrow to talk to everybody members because there's at least six that are vacant. Mm-hmm. What I would encourage is community organizations, if the council member isn't reaching out to the community to have somebody on ACPAC, then maybe the community should go to the council member and say, look, I want to be on it.
Yeah.
That's all I got.
One suggestion.
Somebody's got to reach out.
Right.
Okay, so I'm going to bring it up to the common council tomorrow.
Right.
And if they don't reach out, give them the courtesy of reaching out and appointing the people. If they don't do it, then I think after that is a media push to get the community to say, hey, I want to do it, okay. And then
this
go to them.
The new president of the common council.
And we are reorganizing, so
yeah.
Members can stay for 5 minutes afterwards, please. Yeah.
So that was going great, but it sort of fell apart. There also needs to be some support in whatever way we can for the community review board as well. So we made that recommendation. Any other questions? Yes.
I would like to know how this survey was conducted. I knew nothing about it until tonight.
Yeah, well,
how were people surveyed?
Oh, you weren't here when I went over that.
But part of making it a living document is continuing to solicit more community feedback.
We had it on our website.
So you want your feedback still.
Yeah, it's all in there.
Yeah.
How we actually did it.
It's all in where?
You have to spend a little time on Facebook.
We trained a bunch of volunteers to attend community events that were happening at that time. None were specifically targeted, just within, we did it over the course of a month. Was it March?
May.
It was one of Emily's. We did it over the course of the month. So every single community event we were aware of, we had volunteers there with physical hard copies stopping anybody who wouldn't answer. We're a small staff
Small.
So then we put it online electronically on our Facebook page. We shared it. We shared it to Reddit. We shared it on our website.
Was there an article in the paper about it?
There were several. After it was done.
Once it was done, yeah.
And we don't get to, you know, we don't get to dictate to the media what they put in the paper. But we did release that we were doing this. And we understood we couldn't get to every single person and all we were with the point of putting it online. Again, I do want to point out that people from every single zip code responded. So, you know, once that deadline came, we set the end date for the last day of the month. We took everybody we had, but we didn't use the ones who refused to give us a zip code.
Right. We still want your feedback.
But the report, again, is on the website, so you can read the whole thing. Yes.
Further question or comments about 50A. And my understanding is that's a statewide law.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I just want to point out, for better or worse, what a third rail that is going to be with the police unions throughout New York State. And my thoughts there are, you know, I could just see the union leader in New York City alone rallying, you know, that huge police force, you know, against a movement like that. My thought is, could there be any opportunity to create, I don't know what I want to call them, unsanctuary cities? Is there any way that we could say in Albany, okay, we're going to move away from this, instead of the uphill battle of trying to get rid of this through the entire state?
I would doubt it, but maybe the chief gets on the bottom of that.
I don't think they're going to get a city to go against it.
Not only that, when we did the Civilian Review Board, the one thing we couldn't get was subpoena power for it, because the police stood up in the Common Council, and that would not change.
We're all talking at the same time. But from my own perspective, I don't think it's going to happen.
I mean, my last thought on that is that you can go on WebMD and see the history, performance history of your doctor or surgeon. You can go on Yelp and or the health department listings and see how a restaurateur has done. I mean, what we're asking is nothing more than anybody else in other lines of work is subjected to.
Can I just say one last thing? For people who don't want to do like a handwritten, if you go to our website under the survey, I have enabled comments. You can leave your feedback right on our website, cflsa.org.
And if anybody has not signed the sign-in sheet, please do so. And before I forget, special appreciation to Mark Manning.